Plot twists. We are obsessed with them. In film, life, and love, they turn up everywhere. It's that moment in a story that takes you in an unexpected direction. I'm Tom, super fan of cinema, sport, comedy, and I'm partial to the odd impression. And throughout this series, brought to you by Now and Sky, I'll be interviewing TV and film stars, asking them all about the plot twist moments that define their lives and careers. So expect the unexpected, and hopefully some behind-the-scenes gems you've never heard before. Expect spoilers. You know, there's rumors online about celebrities, what they're like as a person. Keanu Reeves, meant to be a wholesome, lovely man. And my guest this week has that reputation as well. He also happens to be an amazing actor, Giancarlo Esposito. So excited for this interview. Now, you'll know from last week, I've been watching Mary and George. I've just finished it. It is amazing, and you can watch it on Sky Now. But if you paid any attention to Netflix lately, you'll know that Guy Ritchie has a new series, The Gentleman. Theo James is leading. He's supported by Kaya Scodelario, Daniel Ings, Ray Winston, Vinnie Jones, and Giancarlo Esposito. It follows Eddie Halstead, who's played by Theo. He inherits his family estate, this massive estate, but he discovers it's home to an enormous weed farm and its proprietors aren't going anywhere. And what follows is comedy and chaos. And Giancarlo is, from the first episode, he's brilliant, as he always is. This very meticulous, interesting character. You know there's more to come. So do go and watch that on Netflix. It is great fun. Back to Giancarlo. He was born in Copenhagen to an African-American mother who was touring Europe with the iconic French dancer and singer Josephine Baker, and meets Giovanni Esposito, a stagehand who hailed from Naples. And after 6 years of touring Europe, they move back to America, to New York. And within a few years, Giancarlo is on Broadway. And I guess that's where the love affair with acting starts. And what follows is this incredible list of titles he's been in. Do the Right Thing with Spike Lee, The Usual Suspects, a massive film in the 90s. But you could say a turning point was a little show called Breaking Bad. Gus Fring, listed as one of the most iconic TV villains ever. In fact, he's in the top 10 of Rolling Stone's greatest TV villains of all time. That's how impactful this role was for Giancarlo. It's a role that solidified the show's own cult following. And then, of course, with streaming services and it going mainstream, it has become a cultural phenomenon. And of course, Gus Fring, we've now seen in Better Call Saul, the prequel, and that in its own right is amazing. It was such an iconic performance, so well disguised. And going into the interview, that was something I really wanted to delve into a little bit more. Following Breaking Bad, off the back of that success, Moff Gideon in The Mandalorian. He's been in The Boys, playing Stan Edgar. Godfather of Harlem. He just seems like one of those actors that just doesn't seem to turn in a poor performance. As a man, he's known for his style, always looks the business, and he's known for his attention to detail. And that's kind of where the interview started, where I asked him about his hat, and then we ended up talking about hat etiquette. And I also realized that the first time I'd seen Giancarlo on screen was playing Cassius Marcellus Clay Sr., Muhammad Ali's dad, in the Michael Mann film Ali, starring Will Smith. So that is where we kind of pick things up. Here is the distinguished and exceptional Giancarlo Esposito on Plot Twist.
And you know why you never touch another man's hat? There are a couple of reasons why you take it off that way, because the oil from your hands will then wear this away.
Of course.
I see. I'm a hat guy. This is a penman.
I know you are. I know you are.
John Penman from Portland, Oregon. Anyway, there's our little
Well, hat. No, I appreciate that. That was great.
I mean, yeah. Hey. I mean, he told you more than you probably wanted to know.
No, no.
But since we got 45 minutes, we might as well talk about some
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, we've got lots to talk about. Firstly, it's an honor to have you on this show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I thought, ciao, Giancarlo. Let's
ciao, bella.
Yeah. My Italian's pretty limited. I did have a friend called Gianluca who told me, mi hai fatto il bidone. Translates loosely, apparently, that you left me by the bins when I wouldn't go to the gym with him. Mi hai fatto il bidone.
Mi hai fatto il bidone.
Apparently. He could be just, you know, could be bending.
It sounds correct to me.
Yeah, okay. All right.
Yeah. Is that a way of saying that you're a bald-headed stepchild who was left on a doorstep?
Probably. No, Gib. Probably. Yeah. I realized, actually, on screen, the first time I probably saw you was playing Cassius Marcellus Clay Sr. in Michael Mann's Ali. And Muhammad Ali is my hero. And I thought an interesting place to start would be talk about who would be your hero.
Wow. Who would be my hero?
Yeah.
Muhammad Ali was one of my heroes, and I met him at a very young age on 50th Street in Broadway when he was protesting the draft. And it happened to be a building there where I was going for an audition with my mother. I had to be late 60s. I had to be 10 or 11.
Wow.
Because I was born in 58. And we came out of the building, and there was this man, you know, having this little small, what looked like a rally. And I'm like, who is that? And it was Muhammad Ali, because that's where the draft office was. And he was explaining to all these press people who were around him and all this stuff. And that was one of my first experiences of him in person. You know, booming voice, great personality, very, very gregarious and gesticulating and very over the top.
Braggadocio.
Yeah, braggadocio, yeah. Really. He was one of my heroes because of what he believed in, but also I'm an athlete from a young age, a runner, and never did college or high school or college sports, but believed in moving my body, and he really had great control over his body and was just a really great fighter and also a very smart fighter. Mm. So the way he danced really impressed me because I was somewhat of a dancer at a young age too, but in a different way on the Broadway stage, so it's a different kind of movement. But he was one of my heroes during that time. Another great hero for me was Sidney Poitier. Mm. But getting back to Muhammad Ali, having the opportunity to play his father was an important moment in my life, you know, especially for such a terrific filmmaker as Michael Mann. And Michael is a very thorough filmmaker, mm. very, very similar to Guy in some ways, that he uncovers every piece of juice about a character that he can. And he's also mindful and thoughtful in the way that he does it. So in terms of that, it's the way he speaks to an actor. In a way, through those conversations, it guides you to a performance. And certainly, I hadn't known about Muhammad's contentious relationship with his father. So it led me back to history, you know, mm-hmm. to learning about his name, you know, because in that film, our scenes were really about his name, about him having a white man's name, and you were so, you know, very profoundly verbal when you came in and said, you know, Cassius Marcellus Clay. You know, his father was very proud of his name, even though it came from a slaveholder. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud of my name, so I related to that. You know, oftentimes we get a role as an actor, you can relate to certain things about the character you're being asked to play. And if you relate it to yourself, you get that feeling of what it means. And that translates to, you know, your interests and you're digging deeper. So for me, it was always an interesting investigation, you know, about what is a name, how do you relate to it? My name is Giancarlo Giuseppe Alessandro Esposito, right? And for years, I didn't say my name that way.
Mm. So what did you say?
Giancarlo Esposito, because I'm Americanized, and if I said Giancarlo, I always feared, I was already teased, bullied over the color of my skin and the way I spoke, that if I said my name that way, my fear was that people would think I'm affected. When in actuality, my name is Giancarlo Esposito. That's how you say it. What's the shame in that? Mm. There is none, but of course, what we identify with is, you know, if I'm trying to be an actor and trying to have a household name where everybody in the world knows me, and you're in America, that's my, you know, I went from Italy when I was 5, to America, that's what I identified with, so I had to have people identify with that too. Mm. And it wasn't until I started to become more confident and become a bit famous. I think it started on Jay Leno. It may have been right around that time I did the Jay Leno show, and something clicked inside me when he asked me my name, and I said, Giancarlo Esposito. It's Esposito. And I said, well, no, it's not Esposito. You know, and in America, we grew up with Tony and Phil, hockey players, famous. Mm. And that's how you said the name. And now, after going back to Italy for many years, visiting and getting in touch with my roots, then I started to realize this is how I should always say my name.
Absolutely. I know Madonna wanted to take away Esposito.
Yeah, she wanted to take it away completely. Wow. Yeah, sharing a trailer with her on Desperately Seeking Susan. You know, she said, why don't you just call yourself Giancarlo? But actually, she said Giancarlo.
Yeah.
And I went, that's exactly me. And hi, it's Louise. Yeah. I mean, that's how I knew her. I knew her as Louise.
Right.
You know, and we were in this little trailer on Desperately Seeking Susan. And oh my gosh, there's a little louver door in between. And she had to change on one side. I had to change on the other. I had a much smaller role. She's the lead in the piece. You know, she just shared this trailer with me because it was a low budget film by Susan Seidelman.
Right.
And I caught her peeking through the Louvre door, and I said, I can peek too, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel I feel like I did the right thing, because I think part of the prefix, suffix, beginning and end, it's a completion. You know, and for a moment, I think I considered it, you know, mildly, but I felt like pop stars and singers and musicians might just have one name. But actors, there's something complete about my name that I really love.
Going back to when you meet Ali in the late 60s, I think he did a Broadway show himself called Buck White, I believe, at that sort of time.
Big time Buck White.
Yeah.
I believe you're absolutely correct. Yeah. Belafonte was in it.
Yeah.
Wow. I think he was in it for a little bit.
Not for long, I don't think.
But not for long.
But that also was effectively the start of your career.
It was. It was, and I looked to Belafonte and Muhammad Ali, and all of whom knew each other, and Sidney Poitier as real role models. Muhammad Ali, because he stood up for himself and declared his blackness, and he needed to take a new name. It was important for him to become Muhammad, partly because of his association with the Nation of Islam and the whole spiritual connection. They claimed him right away, and they guided his career, handled everything for him that he needed, but it gave him a sense of belonging to a family that he didn't really belong to. Now, isn't that the case for so many of us? You know, if we don't really feel, we feel disenfranchised from our families, then we don't feel supported or comforted in many ways. And Ali found that through the Nation of Islam. Whereas Sidney Poitier, who came from Jamaica, who also, you know, struggled through his share of racism in Florida, I think that's how he came to New York, because he was in Florida and police came to his door for some crime or something that had happened, and they suspected him, and his parents got him right out of there to New York, which allowed him to become an actor and start his own business. He had a restaurant, all these things. But what I loved about Sidney was that that didn't taint him to a point where he hated white people or had to act what he thought would be black to be accepted. And to me, that was my guy, because he conducted himself with comportment and self-esteem. He had a great amount of self-esteem, but dignity is the word I'm looking for. He was really dignified and was not ashamed to speak the way he did.
I was going to say, but authentic.
Very authentic. And to me, that represented a total human being, a complete human being. He didn't have to remind you that he had black skin, didn't have to remind you any of that. He demanded to be accepted for who he was. And for me, in my career, it exemplified my journey, because I wasn't accepted as African-American, as black, by blacks. And I go back to when I was in school, you know, people, what are you? You know, I had a friend, Paul Budish, who used to call me Giancarlo Esposito Mal, which means bad, bad, bad. Or is it Gene Harlow? Or is it Juan Carlo? Right, so I was always taken for something else and called out for it, and then being asked to explain. How do you say your name? Where are you from? Who are you? What nationality are you? So all those things made me a bit paranoid. So becoming an actor, I took on a lot of different, I learned how to play, took on a lot of different masks, learned how to play different characters so I could fit in. In acting, you want to get a gig. So early on, if people thought I was Spanish, I let them think I was Spanish. And I learned how to play, do a Spanish accent. Speak a little Spanish, street New Yorkan, speak street Spanish, so I could fit in, so I could get a part. And it caused a little disruption in my identity. You know, it disrupted kind of me really finding out who I am and getting comfortable in my own skin. Mm-hmm. But being an actor would disrupt that, because you, in a way, take on all these different characters and think you're all these different people, and it takes a little longer, for some people, but for me, to find out who I really am. And to speak from a voice that really inspires me inside, that is my intuitive voice. And that started to come, but it came through playing all these very different mixtures of human beings until I realized that I can't live in any one of those. I'm not living my life in a script. I'm living my life for me. And what does that mean for me? And so it's interesting, you know. Mm. I find it's interesting being, you know, in the UK with actors. Related a story, because I speak at colleges and universities for many years, that in France, you're a Frenchman. Doesn't matter what color you are. In England, you know, you're British, you're English, right? But in America, it was black or white. So I used to speak a lot about this because it was really telling to me. When I first came to the UK and someone said, "Hey, mate," and I turned around and it was this black dude with this big, huge afro, I was like, "Huh?" You know, like, "What?" And I said, "Where are you from?" "The UK." I'm here in London, London town, North End. It's like, "Excuse me?" You know, so to start to realize that many of us are immigrants. Now, can I tell the English person who is from that lineage for many, many years? Of course. I start to be able to differentiate and know that. But why can't we be proud of our country if we're, you know, brown skin and raised here from birth? My world opened up. Started to understand, oh, it's just that we feel this really intense racism in America. We probably feel some here too, many places you go, but it's not relegated to just one place. But I found the acceptance, because I was born in Copenhagen, raised in Italy. Mm. So I have, as Spike Lee would coin me, an Afro-European. As Spike would say, you're an Afro-European. But that's the truth. I am. And so I have a European sensibility. So whenever I come to Europe, UK, Italy, I feel somehow more at home. And I think part of it is geographically and structurally. Mm. You know, I feel like I'm in an ancient city when I'm here.
That makes sense. I want to come back to you on your parents, because I think that story and Josephine Baker is fascinating as well. But this is the Plot Twist podcast, and it's about plot twists in our lives, unexpected moments that can change our story. Giancarlo, what is your plot twist?
I think some of my big plot twist in my life is, it's in conjunction with finding out at a young age that I was meant for the stage and I was meant for film. My plot twist is, in my heart, I thought I would be a priest because I have a great sense of service and wanting to help people.
And discipline.
And I have a really strong discipline. So when I went to military school at a young age and poured the wine for the priest to say mass, and they were pretty tanked by the time the mass came, and mass was being done in Latin, I thought that would be a part of my life. And the plot twist was kind of the abuse that happened for me in military school. Physically, corporal punishment, the advances from priests, all of that really tainted me, and it kind of broke my heart. And so my plot twist is, for me, is that, oh, there, I'm going to find something else that I'm interested in doing. And it also played into my big ego and my great sense of myself. Somehow, the years in military school and the discipline to getting up at 5 in the morning and putting on vestments and being pious, you know, having a support from a sacred organization that felt pure, believing in God, and then having that kind of crushed in a way, and trying to understand that my dedication had nothing to do with an organization, that many organizations religiously, spiritually are flawed because there's hierarchies. And so then I dug deeper and started reading some Eastern philosophies and all that, and then moving into feeling as if I could serve and be helpful through performance, like take people and lift them from one place to another in what I do would be good for me. And then another plot twist that came for me is that, oh, then there's all this attention and I could be a star. Oh, okay. And so I chased that for a little while thinking, okay, and at any moment, something's going to happen for me where it's going to change my life economically because I'm going to make money and I'm also going to get all this attention. And then realizing that that is not really what was going to happen. And that was another moment in time where I went, oh, okay. Everything guiding me back to asking me what my intentions were. Like, what do you want? And then realizing I'm an actor. That's what I really am. I have a craft and a talent. Why don't I just do that? Then I watched people just, in my mind then, pass me. Just go right past me and get the network TV job and be on a network show for 5 years and get really rich and get the big movie, you know? I mean, I auditioned for some stuff. Denzel in Washington was up for a movie called Carbon Copy with George Segal. And it was between me and Denzel. And Denzel got it. Sword, right? I auditioned for Stanley Kubrick. He didn't fly. I videotaped for him and sent it for Steel Metal Jacket. I didn't get it. You know, I've since known Vincent D'Onofrio, great actor, I've worked with him. It's still one of those that wasn't meant for me, but in somewhere in my mind I go, is that one that got away or just one that never came to fruition? So when I realized that, okay, stardom is one thing, celebrity is a whole other thing, being an actor is one thing, but what I really was striving for was to be an artist. So here's a third plot twist, is that I'm an artist, which means in my brain I'm always going to be broke. I'm going to go for the role, not the money. I'm going to go for working with the right director and other actors and actresses who could stretch my talent, because that'll be my reward.
Mm. Pure passion. I love it.
Yeah.
You do get those big roles later. And some roles you're very known for. And I wondered if you'd say Gus Fring was a plot twist in that it projects you to a whole new level in terms of the success of that show. But I was wondering beforehand, I think you've said in other interviews, that the types of roles that you were playing before then were quite similar. As an artist, were you enjoying that period pre-Breaking Bad?
Yes, I was. I went bankrupt prior to Breaking Bad, and my marriage started to crumble because I couldn't provide for my family, which give you an insight into a man provides. No matter if he's loved or respected, he holds up. That speech to me, I even added lines to that speech because I had been through crushing blows in my life. But prior to that, it was my integrity okay, so I was doing, it wasn't until I got to Law and Order that I started playing lawyers. But I was playing street thugs. And, you know, I loved it. I was terrorizing people. Like, you know what I mean? Right. It was like I was robbing people on the street in a soap opera, burning down the gymnasium. You know, I was a tough guy. And, you know, I always thought that tough guy came from my growing up in New York until I went back to Naples, Italy and realized, oh.
A different kind of tough guy.
I think the menace that you felt in Breaking Bad from Gustavo was directly connected to me being Neapolitan. I mean, I'm brutally ruthless. I will cut your throat. I will kill you. Like, when I was young, I'd go for the biggest guy in the room, and you're pretty big. Yeah, I like that. Take a big man down from the middle. No, you know, so I didn't want to, during the 70s, what was the 80s, that I just started to feel like I was a stereotype. Like, not literally a stereotype, but if I keep doing this, those are the roles I was getting, guest spots, that's all I would do. And that also, it cast a shadow and reflected upon my ethnicity, because I'm thinking I'm black, right? And everyone else does. So when you walk down the street and the old lady pulls the pocketbook close to her, or crosses the street, or looks at you twice and doesn't make eye contact, you know, you're a threat. And I started to feel less than enough and bad about myself. And I wonder if I keep playing these roles, that I'm propagating that myth. And so I did it as a black man, and then I started doing it as Spanish, because there weren't, Leguizamo wasn't on the scene yet, David Labioso before him, he's disappeared, Miguel Alejandro, like, he's not around anymore. There weren't a plethora of Spanish actors who could take that. So I just had the accent, and I would roll with it. and I was a fake, a fraud, but did it really well. So when I made a conscious decision to stop, is my point, which is like, that was courageous of me. I don't know how the hell I did it. I said, I'm not going to do those roles anymore. I'm just not doing it. And, you know, I starved for a while. And things weren't I wanted to be regarded for my talent and what I do because I felt like I had the ability to be great, whatever that means, great to me. You know, then it was like, yeah, I'm going to be great to the world. I'm going to blow it out of the water. So prior to Breaking Bad, I was really in trouble. You know, I was in trouble personally. I was in trouble with my family. I was, you know, bankrupt, moved to Connecticut, couldn't do it. My marriage failed. And I knew I was losing everything. And that was the lowest point. And then Breaking Bad came, and that was a serious plot twist. Because for me to have enough inner intuitive connection to, I said yes to the guest. I didn't. So my manager, Josh, called me into this show about Breaking Bad. Never heard of it, never seen it. Okay, well, they want you to audition. Oh, okay. I'd gotten Once Upon a Time, Something to Save My Life, a couple of guest spots on that, Sydney, right? So I said, send me a DVD. And I looked at it, I said, yeah, it's a good show. Okay, so I went out, I went and taped for it. They gave me direction, and I got moved on to Sharon Bialy, who begged me to come in again. And I went, Sharon, you know, at this point, I'd done so many guest spots, I didn't want to do anymore. She said, you come in, you're getting this job. Everyone in Hollywood wants this job. From Philip Seymour Hoffman to Boom, but she named all these names. Philip Seymour Hoffman was dying for this job.
One actor. Mm.
A wonderful actor. So I went in and I read, and an hour later she was calling me saying, Vince, because Vince wants you, he loves you, but everyone's got to read. And I got it. And I went and did the guest spot. That's all it was. And when I did the guest spot, I got off the plane back, you know, in New York.
But they offer you more. And you say, hang on. You want to find out more about where
That's
this is
right.
going,
you know,
which is the passion that comes through, right?
Yeah, because I didn't want to. Again, I was trying to move away from stereotypical characters. And if this guy's just another stereotype, I don't really want to play him. Mm. And then I realized, oh, shit, you should just share your ideas. You got ideas. Mm. You know, it's not like you're saying no. You're saying no to this. And I didn't know. I didn't know Vince Gilligan. So put me on the phone with him. And everyone thinks that's kind of outrageous. But, like, you know, you go for a job interview. Look, this is all the things I can do for you.
Yeah.
Right, I'm going to talk about, you know, like...
But to work for that company, it's like, what are your principles?
That's right. It's exactly right. And I started to get it, you know? Like, I started to get it. Like, how can I serve you when you serve me? Because it's a two-way street. So, you know, I had a brief conversation with Vince, and I felt like through the conversation, he didn't directly answer all of the questions, but I felt like his integrity was up to par, and he didn't want to create a stereotype. And that he wanted a villain... You know, kind of hated that too, but that's how we refer to it. You know, a villain that had legs. I come from Broadway. You know, does the show have legs? Will it play in Peoria? You know what I mean? That's really what he wanted, right?
Because
right. He had a villain of the week. Yeah. You know, a guy to come in and terrorize and kill him off in the next episode. And when he said, I realized that, then it was immediate yes, because it means I could be around for a while and develop something.
Mm.
Not that I'm like coming in and wreaking havoc and then kill me. Right? Beg to be killed, or they want to kill you anyway. And that to me is like, you know, that's my James Cagney moment. Top of the world, Ma! You know, you're going to go out big. You know, you're in for a penny, you're in for a pound. You know, just go for it. And I love those roles. But this was different. And I treated it differently. And because I really learned how to breathe, I really learned how to, I wasn't trying to be intimidating. I just left a lot of silence. I looked, you know, the eyes are the window to the soul. So I looked deep. And in that stillness that I was able to create, there was space for me to really hear the music of what's happening in there in between the lines. And it was something that came to me because I couldn't rewrite the lines. As an actor, we think we're pretty smart. They're pretty worldly, and you get scripts that are marginal, but you're going to make it better for you and better for the guy who wrote it. He doesn't know it yet, but you know better. But with Vince, the lines were perfect, and I thought, how do I create this guy? How do I make him just seamless and powerful? And there, all the intimidation came in. Because I profess that people are uncomfortable when you leave space. They're uncomfortable.
They want to fill the gap.
They want to fill the gap. And I didn't try to do that. to leave the gap. The gap is good.
I love how you're speaking like that, and there's a siren in the background. Yeah, it kind of adds to the ambience of the tension here.
Yes, it does.
And I should say to listeners, you were giving me the look. And I could feel it, you know, I could really feel it. Well, you mentioned Ali at the beginning, and the reason why he's my hero is courage. And I think for you in that moment, after everything you've been through in the years before, to still stick to your principles and your passion, that's a lot of courage, man.
They offered me, you know, after the guest spot, between the second and third season, they offered me a contract. And it meant they'd have to give me a holding fee. And I said, no. I needed it. I said, no. Like, you know, it's the evidence of things unseen. Because if I had taken that, I would not be able to take any other work or have to ask them first. And I didn't know them as business people. Since then, I know AMC and I know I can do five jobs with them. And Vince is very, you know, if you're working somewhere else, it just helps us. You know, I mean, you know, you're being seen. But I didn't know that, so I said no. And I said, why don't you call me when you start to think about your next season? And if you still feel the same way, then we'll talk. But yeah, I think I'm really blessed to have a modicum of courage. And I've always had this piece of me that's fearless. You know, when I'm supported, you know, when I feel like I'm supporting myself and lifting up my best self, I feel like that's what's really helped me survive.
It paid off. And here we are a few years later, talking about The Gentlemen, spin-off of the film. You mentioned a lot of great directors, actually, you know, Spike Lee and Michael Mann and Guy Ritchie. That must have been it must be a pleasure working with him. And tell me about his sort of style when you are.
I'm going to blow my nose.
Please do.
And then I'll continue. Oh, I have to refold my little nappy. Do you call it a nappy? My handkerchief. Someone asked me on the red carpet last night about British slang. What's my favorite British slang word? I couldn't come up with anything. I finally did find something, but it's not a nappy. It's a handkerchief. Kerchief, handkerchief. What do you call this shit? What's your slang for this?
I would have said handkerchief.
Handkerchief.
Yeah.
Me too.
I was going to talk about Freddie, one of the characters in the show, and describe him as a bit of a silly Billy. That would be a sort of a...
Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Silly Billy.
Yeah.
I like it. Boys, Daniel's wonderful.
Great actor.
Great actor. Really great. And to be able to be in a Guy Ritchie piece is to be able to encompass not only the dramatic tension of being threatening, but also the comedic, it's like the high wire act, the comedic part of that.
There's a lot of comedy in there.
A lot of comedy.
Yeah.
That's really hysterically funny. And then, woof, something really nasty happens and you go, ooh, you know, which is, it happens, it's real. And you know, you take it in and you move on as if it's a part of life. But you feel it. And so working with Guy is, you know, I've been in the business a long time. So, you know, you hear from other actors how someone is. And I heard, oh, Guy, he never comes out of his trailer. He directs from there. He'll do everything from there. And I've been with other directors who do the same thing. You know, Coppola directs through a megaphone or his silverfish and has monitors in there. He can see everything and doesn't have to come out and be physically present. So my expectation was, you know, look, you just go, you learn your lines, you do your thing, and maybe you'll meet Guy Ritchie in the process. Yeah. I mean, you know what I mean? After all, it is his movie.
Yeah. Well, David Beckham on the red carpet.
Yeah.
You know? There you go.
Yeah, exactly. So I had no real expectations, and it turned out to be greater than any expectation I could have ever had, because there were long conversations with Guy. I mean, my story is I get off the plane, much like coming to the premiere. I just was somewhere else lecturing. I was in L.A. shooting 48 hours ago. And I get off the plane, and I'm in my trailer, and I make sure I'm locked down. My brain's good. Lulu hooked me up. Lulu Bonton. I have great costume. Great. Feeling good. Feeling like Stanley. Stanley Johnston.
With a T.
And I'm walking to the Gentleman's Club, and I see this little trailer on the side of the street, and they're leading me in. They went, oh, 1 second. Wait, hold on a minute. Oh, yeah, no, we're going to go into Guy's trailer. Oh, okay. We go into Guy's trailer and literally have sitting there with him for an hour. And talking about life, kids, music, culture, just was just a really natural conversation where he wasn't trying to impress me. I wasn't trying to impress him. We, you know, just talking. And I said something about privilege or growing up and how I grew up. Oh, it's perfect to lead us back to the scene today. I went, oh, okay. Now, I don't know if I have it right. I go, oh, you have it right. Well, it's right. But I don't know if this is it. And then I go, all right, I've been up half the night, got off the plane, learning the lines, getting it right, precise, all that. We may just do something else, throw it all out. And I'm like, what? Okay. So what do you think about this? What do you think about this? Well, I think about this. Do you think we said it there? Do you think we got me doing it? I think, but, well, because there is something. I think this was missing. Oh, okay. So what if I said it like this? In the meantime, Matthew Reeves is sitting there typing away, and there's a machine going in the back, printing, spitting this shit out, all these ideas. And we come up with something completely different, and it's a whole lot of dialogue. And he hands it to me and says, can you do this? How long do we have? Oh, 10 minutes. You be all right with that? And I went, yeah, let me skedaddle, and I'll have a look. And, oh, and you know, I can put it on boards for you if you like. No, boards, what are those? I can write it out, hold it by the camera. It's really okay. And I said, no, I'm good. And I went and I thought, my mind, having the paper in front of me, was still in our conversation. It was about kings and queens and art and aristocracy and privilege and money and criminality. My mind was exploding. And I went, okay, shit. Back to my breathing practice. Okay, let's break this down. Went and I nailed it. And I went, that's amazing.
You did.
I had all this stuff in my brain. I could let it go and be present with Guy. So it's a different way of working. It's very thorough, very complete.
You can see that in the performance. Congratulations. I want to ask you one final question.
Absolutely.
Plot twist person, an unexpected source of inspiration. I imagine in your, is it what, 54 years in your career?
It's 56 now.
56. There might be quite a few, but if there was an unexpected source of inspiration in your life, who might that be?
Paul Newman and George C. Scott. Two separate experiences. George C. Scott, I was 13 years old, and he had done Uncle Vanya, and we shared the Eurus Theater. I was doing Seesaw. In the middle of an interview, he snuck up behind me. Then, and the way it was on my night off during previews, we had one night off, I could see his show, and they had one night off, they could see mine, and he had come to see mine, and I don't think I went to see his. To be really honest with you, he stuck up behind me, put his big arm around me, and I didn't know it was him. I was in the middle of an interview in the restaurant, the theater restaurant after the show, and he was like, don't do it. I was like, who the frick is this? But I kind of knew. And I turned around, and it was George C. Scott. And he said, unless you really have to. And he was really drunk. And you never forget that. You know, he was basically saying, don't do it unless you're a lifer. If you're a lifer, do it. So it changed the way I thought about what I do, and it deepened my commitment and my passion, and it made me understand that, to me, George C. Scott was a god. I worked with him twice, two more times. Once, I never worked with him in that moment. He told me that advice, and then I was on the set of The Changeling, where I was literally an extra, walking, passing him in Lincoln Center. Never spoke to him, right? Just passed him, because I was a little embarrassed. I'm an extra. He saw me. My own number and my own show. And then came Taps, and the movie Taps, where he came and I played Captain J.C. Pierce, and I got a chance to speak to him and then thank him for that great advice, because by this time I'm 18, 19 years old, from 13, and this guy to me was iconic, the iconic actor. So that was that plot twist moment. And then Paul Newman, later on, toward the end of his life, I did a movie called Twilight with him. And he affected me through his action, too, watching how he lived his life, treated other people, and dealt with his work as an actor. And we bonded over cars. I drove up in a 1961 Volvo B-122S to Connecticut, where we were rehearsing with Robert Benton directing, and he was at the window of the rehearsal building, and he saw me pull in, and I walked in, and he's like, hey, is that your car? Black 122S? Well, yeah, he's Volvo man. And that led to me going to the racetrack with him, sitting with Joanne Woodward on the grass, watching him race on a day that he won, he and Bronwyn.
Wow.
Yeah. And that led to me going to see him in our town, having dinner with him, learning about his philanthropy, his Our Gang camp, where he contributed and gave back. Makes me think about tithing and giving back. A real mensch, a guy who really believed that he, if he had the ability, he would lift society up from his contribution, not only as an actor, but also in through his creations of what he created for other people. So
those two are pretty good.
Yeah, to me, those moments of inspiration from people like that are completely important. So that led me to what I really do today. This is just my side job. You know that?
Yeah.
It's my side job. But I speak at universities, colleges, and universities all across America. I've been invited to Oxford.
Wow.
So I'll probably speak there this year. And it's almost as if they invite me because I'm, you know, Moff Gideon, Gustavo Fring, or Stan Edgar, or bugging out from Do the Right Thing. And then the plot twist there, that's why I'm telling you this, is that I answer all the questions they have to ask of me, but then I speak to the inspiration that uplifts young people and students and older people too in how I talk about how to get to their goals. You know, what you do today determines your tomorrow, allowing your dreams to soar and allowing them to, inviting them to come to fruition, doing something to make that happen, enlisting friends and family for support of that. If you don't like what you do, why are you still doing it? Why don't you switch and change? Because you're supposed to love what you do, and then you never work a day in your life.
Well, you've inspired me, so thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Can we do a little Breaking Bad end? You know,
sure.
You've probably been asked this before.
Sure.
But, say thanks and shake my hand.
Oh.
Can we do that to end, if you say that?
Sure. Say thank you.
Thank you.
Now shake my hand.
Wow. Giancarlo Giuseppe Alessandro Esposito. Wasn't that incredible? A fascinating chat, a fascinating person. One of those conversations that you end up thinking about it for days afterwards based on what it said. One of those that cuts through and gets you thinking. I could have spoken to him for hours. Similar to Nicholas Galitzin last week, there were so many other things I wanted to talk about. His parents moving around Europe in the early stages of his life. What they thought of his acting career as he starts to make it. That would have been really interesting. Lots of themes come from the interview. Service and discipline. What a plot twist, by the way, that he was going to be a priest. In his heart, that's what he was set on. Although I was thinking, as a priest, he'd be quite a formidable face, to confess to at some points. That would be that would be interesting. The other thing that was amazing was the plot twist. The third plot twist, as he said, being an artist, that he'll always be broke. And they'll always go for the right role, the right director, with the right cast members. Breaking Bad is a great example of that. He needed the money desperately. He needed the opportunity. He needed the contract. But he wanted to do it right. He wanted to push back and say, look, take your time. Let's get this right. But my goodness, it paid off. Wow. And that was something else. It was the humility of the man. Even when he spoke about having some ego, there was something disarming about it where I was like, yeah, you have your ego. That's all good. But he was very open about the trials and tribulations of his life. And I guess there's a message there about running your own race. He had the opportunity versus Denzel Washington, didn't get it, but these bigger roles have come later down the line. And my goodness, he's taken them. What a chat. Wow. If ever, Giancarlo, you want to come back, you are more than welcome anytime. Big thank you to him. And from one American star to another, Eric Stonestreet next week, you might know him as Cameron Tucker from Modern Family, is coming on Plot Twist to talk about his life and career. It's a great chat. We recorded earlier in the year. He is a joy. Looking forward to that. And until then, ciao, guys.